What an absolute gift. Your holiday season means maybe a lot of different things to you, and everybody has the things they treasure the most in their hearts. Honestly, that is my favorite part of all of Christmas. There's just something that's pure and beautiful about the kids kind of expressing that, that makes that what I want it to be. My family, mostly Melissa, but I guess all of us to some degree, watches another child that we know just kind of from our community. We're going to get some more of those in there too, just kind of a great gift for us. This kid is growing up in a home that isn't Christian, but once a week she gets to hang out in our home, and we sing about Jesus, we talk about him. He's just kind of part of our everyday life. We've never indoctrinated her in that, but we have nativity scenes around, and so every Christmas she comes around, she gets to experience those things again. And so this last week, as Melissa was talking with her, she mentioned that when she had a baby, she was going to name the baby Jesus. So it's a good sign that there's some impact that has been kind of filtering through in her life, and that's kind of our joy of being out in the community sharing that as well. What that made me think about later on this week, though, is that it's beautiful, and I think in our culture we have this great appreciation, even broader than the church, for the baby Jesus. But we know that that's not the fullness of who Jesus is. He certainly is a baby, and there's great wonder. We'll get into that on Saturday and on Sunday this next week to discover kind of the wonder of a God who comes in such a small package, so humble and so gentle. But we know that he doesn't stay a baby forever, and there's a richer experience of Jesus. And so as we have our reading out of Isaiah this morning, I want to remind you that there's a Jesus who's fully God as well. He is a baby. He is born into that manger with the angels celebrating, but he is a God of immense power and wonder as well. So as we have that reading, I invite you to think about that. Steve, are you coming to do that for me? All right, Steve's going to do that. I invite you to stand as we have a reading out of Isaiah chapter 40.
Morning, Merry Christmas. The reading is Isaiah 40, verses 12 through 18. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, or the breadth of his hand marked off the heavens? Who has held the dust of the earth in a basket, or weighed the mountains on a scale, and the hills in a balance? Who can fathom the spirit of the Lord, or instruct the Lord as his counselor? Whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him, and who taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge, or showed him the path of understanding? Surely the nations are as a drop in a bucket. They are regarded as dust on the scales. He weighs the islands as though they were fine dust. Lebanon is not sufficient for altar fires, nor its animals enough for burnt offerings. Before him, all the nations are as nothing. They are regarded by him as worthless and less than nothing. With who then, will you compare God? To what image would you liken him? Here ends our reading. Please be seated.
If you've been tracking along in Isaiah, you hit kind of a major turning point, and that's good news for you. Some of that early stage of a whole lot of judgment has transitioned, and as of chapter 40, we hit this kind of new stride where there is just kind of chapter after chapter of the greatness and the wonder of God. Kind of 40 through 66 is honestly some of the richest description of the nature and the kind of God that we have anywhere in Scripture. As we kind of backtrack and get their context as well as ours, though, just so you can throw the first picture up there for me, there's a time for a change of perspective. If you look at that picture, not only does he look kind of mean and scary and brutish and all those kinds of things, but you can also recognize, if you have a little bit of a photographer's eye, that there's a certain perspective that image is arranged from, right? Right, it's from down low, looking up, which makes him look a lot bigger. Right, so a basic photography lesson, if you want to experience a little bit of that, I do that just as a pastime on my own, not in any professional kind of mindset. But there's a lot of different things you can do to communicate through images and through pictures, right, beyond just straight on, this is what happened, where it was. So one of the ways that you communicate is by changing the perspective that you take pictures. right? So they use high angle, low angle, and stuff like that, but animals are just as good for that, right? A snake eyes view, which is largely what this one is, versus a bird's eye view, which is from a much higher perspective, right? And they communicate different things, right? Snakes are very defensive creatures. They're very afraid. They run around a lot, right? They're always nervous about somebody getting near them because they're not very big. There's a lot of things that could just step on them and end their life pretty quickly. So when you view things from down low, everything else around you looks pretty scary, which is largely how snakes live their lives. You might be afraid of them, but I will tell you hands down, they are vastly more afraid of you. That's where they live their life, right? Everything around them is huge. Contrast that with a bird, right? When a bird is flying in the air, is it afraid? No. I mean, there's largely no predators that exist up there for other birds. When they're on the ground, they're in a nest, whatever, they might be afraid and might be cautious about that. But when they're up in the air, they're pretty safe. They're pretty secure. They can see everything around them. They have a tremendous viewpoint, right? They can see for miles in any direction, right? And all those things that for a snake seem really, really huge, for a bird seem really, really small, right? Insignificant. There's a mountain range that for a snake might take, I don't know, a couple generations to cross. For a bird, he's like, in an afternoon, I could just pop to the other side, see what's over there, and pop back. Right? There's a great deal of freedom. There's a great deal of peace that comes from that kind of perspective. And so as God is communicating in these chapters out of Isaiah, he's inviting us to change from that snake eye view to a bird's eye view. He says the troubles that you see around you look largely like this guy, right? You're down there on the ground, and everywhere you look, they are immense. They're challenging. Whether they're the challenges you face in school and the classes that you didn't get to finish up and now you have to take the test later on, or the challenges that you face trying to pull things together financially in a season when you're trying to give more and you can't pull those things together, or with family, whatever else it might be, those seem really large. And God invites us into a new change of perspective. So what we're going to do today is honestly just look at some of that new perspective of who God is. These last chapters just invite us to view God more closely. So Josiah, you can go to the next picture there. So as you look at that picture, which one seems bigger, the woman or the building? The woman does, right? That's the wonder of photography again. Intellectually, we're pretty sure that the building is bigger, right? But because the woman is closer, she seems a lot larger than that. And so Isaiah, in these last chapters, is just going to invite you to say, will you look at God closely? Will you bring God to the forefront of your image? Will you put God in front of your troubles, in front of your concerns, your hopes, your dreams, your fears, whatever else it might be? Because when God's there, he's big enough to handle those things, right? When you put the problem first and God behind, then it's harder to get that perspective. So God invites us in Isaiah to put him first. So we're going to go through this morning just a bunch of verses out of Isaiah in these chapters we read this last week. There's a tremendous amount that's said in there. It's kind of repeated over and over again. I pulled out five themes for us. We're going to touch on those fairly briefly this morning. You can write them down in your notes if you want to kind of remember those. What I hope, though, is that at the end you grab at least one of them. One part of that perspective that in your own life God is inviting you to make bigger, to understand more of. Some of them will be easier, some of them will be harder, but just listen maybe for at least one that comes. The first one that we'll start with is that it's all about me. In Isaiah 46, verse 10, God says that my purpose will stand and I will do whatever I please. Right, for most of us, human to human, that's a really bold and arrogant statement, one that turns us off completely, but God is not another human. And so he begins right at the start and says, hey, I want you to remember that this is all about me. Right, I'm the one that's the center of the attention. I'm the one you should be focused on, not your problems, not your hopes, not your dreams. Me, I am the center of everything. The reading that Steve just had for us out of Isaiah 40 ends by saying, before him, all the nations are as nothing. It doesn't mean they have no value. It doesn't mean God doesn't care about them. But he says, compared to me, nothing else matters. Nothing else has value apart from me. All of your desires and your hopes and your dreams in your life, be you young or be you old, whatever they might be, if you're doing them without God, then they are of absolutely no worth and value. Right? That's maybe not an easy statement, but God says, hey, look at how significant I am. Look at how important I am. He goes on in chapter 45 to say, does the clay compare to the potter, complain to the potter? What is it you're making? Obviously not, right? A little bit of sarcasm finds its way in there. God says, of course not, right? Remember what your role is. You are not the potter. You're not forming your life. You're not crafting out each day by day and deciding where it's going to be and how you're going to end up. That's just sheer arrogance. God says, I'm crafting out your life. Don't complain that I've done it wrong, that I didn't know what I was doing, that I was a fool. I know exactly what I'm doing. Even if the path isn't easy for you, you're the one that has been made, right? So there's humility that comes in these verses. In chapter 42, God says that all of our sin is against God. He said, even if you sinned against other people, ultimately all of your sin is again against me. Every action you've made in your life has either reflected back well on me or poorly on me. You've either honored me in every second of your day or you have dishonored me in every second of your day. But don't lose any sight that every moment of your existence is about me. When you make a meal for your family, you either do it in a way that honors me or in a way that doesn't. When you sit down and watch the TV, you either do it in a way that honors me or a way that doesn't. Everything, God says, is centered on me. And then he goes on to say that even your forgiveness is found in me. He says, I forgive you for my own sake in chapter 43. Even I am the one who blots out your transgressions for my own sake. So anytime you've ever wrestled with something that you've done in your life and said, wow, that's really big, I'm not sure how God can forgive me, God invites you once again to realize even forgiveness isn't about you. Forgiveness is about him. You don't earn your way to forgiveness. You don't ever be good enough to get forgiveness. If you ever get forgiveness, it's because God in his own character says, I choose to be a forgiving God and I want to live in that way toward you. So this is this perspective of God saying, this, it's all about me. There's no moment of your life that you can leave me behind. You might leave this worship service and go on to whatever else you have planned for that moment. But your plans might fail. God's plans don't. And everything that you touch, everything that you experience, God is at the center of all of those things. It is all about me. God also says in these chapters that I am bigger than anything else around me. A few verses later from what Steve read for us, we read that from his throne he looks down and people are like mere grasshoppers. Right? Grasshoppers are not very large. You can fill in ants for that. I love the part that Steve read for us. It's such a beautiful description of this greatness of God. He says that in the hollow of his hand, right? So if you hold your palm there, there's this little space in there, right? What do you think that is? What do you think you could fit in there if you were making a meal or pulling a recipe together? What do you think that measurement would be? I don't know, teaspoon, tablespoon, somewhere in there, depending on the size of your hand, probably, right? You can go home and measure it out and see what it really is. Yeah, my hands are teaspoon hands, right? Whatever they might be, right? But that's what it is. But God says that I measure out the waters. So you can gather the Willamette and you can pour it into God's hand, and the Columbia and pour it into God's hand, and the Clackamas and pour it into God's hand, and then you go ahead and put the Pacific in there and the Atlantic in there, and you can melt all the glaciers anywhere you want to and put those in there. You can melt all of Antarctica and you can put that in there, and there's room to spare. It's not spilling over the edge, right? All of that fits in the hollow of his hand. As a check on perspective for us, right, of the size of God, right? He holds the dust of the earth in a basket. The breadth of his hand measures out the heavens. Billions of light years, right, that we can't even perceive. Our telescopes can't even see the full distance of it. God holds out his hand and says, it's about that big. And everything in existence fits in that space. Right, so there's this calling out of God that says, remember how immense I am. Don't lose sight of whatever issue you face in your life, because when God does that to the universe, your problem is somewhere in there. Right, that's it. Whatever you face fits in that space. God is sufficient, he's larger. He says, remember the size that I have. He goes on in chapter 49 to say that that size matters even as I approach you, because a lot of people think he's just a God for Jews, right? He's a Jewish God. He met with Abraham a long time ago before that first mountain, made his way only following them. And in chapter 49, he says, no, it's too small a thing if I just save the Jews. Like, I can do that easy. That's not even difficult. It's not big enough for me. Right? I'm a God of immense power and immense authority, so I'm just going to save every last person throughout time, in every culture and place and language and people. Right? That's big enough to match my honor and my glory, so I'm going to do that, not just this small kind of thing here. I'm bringing my salvation to the ends of the very earth. So there's a God who says everything is about me, and a God who says I am incredibly big. I'm bigger than anything you can imagine. You don't even have a perspective to fit into those things and understand that. He goes on to speak about time and the nature of that and says, I have been and I will be. Now, there's no limitations on that. Chapter 45, he says, who foretold this long ago and told it in the distant past? So the things that are happening in that moment, God says, I knew that a long time ago. He goes on in chapter 46 to say, I knew the end, even in the beginning. Before anything existed and I could even use my hand to measure things out, God says, I knew how it would all turn out. There are no surprises for God. That's why you can't ever disappoint him. It's a bit of good news, right? Whatever you choose to do today, God already knew you're going to do. And he still chose to love you. He still chose to claim you as his own. There's no disappointment from God's perspective. There's no surprises from God's perspective. Whatever has shocked you in the last month of your life, whatever you didn't see coming that now is requiring extra effort, extra energy, extra whatever it might take from you, right? Didn't surprise God. He's well prepared in advance. He knows all of those things. I have been and I will be. He says, men wither and people fall. He speaks in chapter 40 about the plants that we see around us, right? And as we've come to the end of, it's still fall out there, you know that? Haven't even made it to winter yet. But as we come to the end of fall, like all those plants in our yards fail, right? They all fall. We have our garbage bins and we fill them up with all the detritus of whatever was living and isn't living anymore. God says, we're the exact same thing. You just go over the hill to Willamette Cemetery and you see the same thing, right? Men wither and people fall. You go to a retirement home or a assisted living place and you see the withering in front of your eyes. Right? We don't like to talk about those things, but they're reality. God says that my word stands forever. I don't experience this weakness that you do. I don't have a moment where I begin to lose the track of everything and forget where I put things, right? Which is common for many of us. God says, I don't lose those things. I don't get tired. I don't get weary. I don't run down. There's not a moment in the day where I've just been pushing so hard that I lose it. I don't need to sleep. In every moment, God is the same from the far distant past to the far distant future, right? He doesn't have moments of weakness, moments where he's not zoned in or focused, right? He's always ready to go. He's always all on. Right? So we have a God who is all about me, a God who's bigger than anything we know, a God who has been and will be, and a God who has the greatest kind of love imaginable. In chapter 49, God says that mothers do a great job caring for their children. But it's possible that a mother could forget her child. Right? And we know that in the vast, the large range of that, mothers don't. Most of us, when it comes to Mother's Day, can look back and see someone who was sacrificial on our behalf, someone who did not forget us, someone who was always there on our behalf. But that's not true 100%. There are mothers that even when they've given birth, they've had someone for 9 months inside of them, and then they've given birth, they still make other choices. I don't know what show it was on in my house. It was some kind of intervention thing or something where people are addicted to stuff for a while. I just caught part of it. But there was the mom who was choosing meth over her own kids. All right, so we know that happens in our world, and we know that as much as we try to do the right thing, that our love isn't fully perfect. But here is God saying that I can't ever forget you. I'm not ever choosing anything else over you. There's no moment where I lose sight of the fact that I made you unique as an individual. And that I value you not as one of a number of people in a room or in a building or in a faith or whatever it is, but as the person that I made, right, with this name that I've given to you. God says, I'll never forget you. Chapter 43, verse 4 is one of my favorite verses in Scripture. I don't tattoo lightly. I only do that for things that I believe are permanent. And this was the first one that I ever got. It's on my back. And this verse struck me so powerfully that it wasn't about me. It's not about my good days or my bad days that this comes true. That this is always true about me. Not because of me, but because God said it. So I said, I want that to mark my body so I never forget. And he says, because you are precious and honored in my sight, and because I love you, I'll give my son in exchange for you. It is a beautiful statement of a love that no one else in our world even understands. And so maybe we started with a God who said, hey, it's all about me, and the nations are as nothing to me. But they're not nothing, because I can't forget you, and they're not nothing, because in my choice, in my sight, you are precious. God says, I know full on everything you've done in your life, and I still name you honored. I know every choice you'll ever make in the future, and I love you. And I'll give my very son to be born as a baby and to grow up to adulthood. I'll give him in exchange for you, because I don't want to lose you. All right, that's the wonder of the love that we face again and again. And it might be a story you've heard 1,000 times, but it doesn't dull. It still is beautiful, because no other love story matches it. No other love story is that incredible or that extreme. And so this love is the greatest love we're ever going to know. And so as we match these things up, God says, everything in the world is simply about me. I'm larger and greater than anything else, right? I've existed before everything. I'll exist long after everything fades. I have this love burning in my heart greater than any you will ever experience. Out of the love of humanity or the love of one individual man or woman, nothing will compare to how passionately I delight in you and care about you and honor you. So we ask then the really pressing question, why do you go anywhere else? Right? Where is my competition? Why has this choice been so hard for you? You haven't just run to me, right? When I rack up all of those things I've laid out in front of you, why do you still turn away? Why do you still walk on other paths? Why do you still say your own is better than what I have? He says, who are you going to compare me to? Make a list, right? Put it up there and compare right alongside of me. Here I am. Here's the qualities I have. Here's the way I've shown myself. Put anything else on the other side of that page. Do the positives and negatives, costs and benefits all the way through, whatever else it is. Go ahead and make a comparison. Does anybody even come close? Can you put anything down on that other side that even slightly weighs you against who I am? In chapter 41, God breaks out the sarcasm box. There's actually a lot of sarcasm in these verses. So if you like sarcasm, Isaiah kind of 40 and moving on, there's going to be some really rich moments for you to enjoy that. So he mocks the idols really hard in here. So he's doing that in chapter 41, verse 22. He says, go ahead and bring your idols out. Maybe they can tell us something about the past, right? Tell us what happened way a long time ago, way in the distant past before you were ever born. Or if they can't do that, maybe they can tell us what's going to happen way in the future. And then finally, in this moment of really rich and supreme sarcasm, he says, just do something. Right? Anything. I don't even care. right? Something that will amaze us, something that will show there's something to you. Right? What is it going to be? Where else are you going to go, and what will they provide? What in the world will they possibly do that might benefit or be good for you? Go ahead and line them up there. All their counsel in chapter 47 has only worn you out. Right? You've followed after it all of your life. You've run after these things. You know what it looks like. And it only wears you out. Do you know which nation on all of this earth has the highest incident of mental illness? Think it's Guatemala, Tono? No, Guatemala is actually a really great place to live, right? There's not a whole lot of mental illness that goes on there. It's America. In the midst of all the wealth and all the security and all the freedom that we have, the rates of depression, the rates of anxiety, the rates of bipolar, I mean, you can check through all the mental illnesses, top. Stunningly, over a lifetime, 47% of Americans will be diagnosed with a mental illness. It's one out of two. Right? All of their counsel only wears you out. That's the state of a country that turns its back on God and runs after its own self. And to the degree that we choose to do that, either individually or in large mass, those consequences will still be there. God says, why do you go somewhere else? Why do you run to another God? Right, what have they done for you? Be it wealth, be it pleasure, be it whatever you're running after, my own ability to choose whatever it is that I want. When you follow that path long enough, has it done anything other than wear you out? He goes on in chapter 44 to say, is there any God beside me? Is there anyone else you can even put up on that list? Because I don't even know. I've been in the God neighborhood for a long time. I look out my window all the time. There's no other cars driving up and down the street. I look in the other God homes. There's nobody that lives in there, right? There's no other God. I've been around for a long time, God says. I've looked around. I can't find another one. I look in the caves. I look up in the trees. I can't find these other gods. Where are they hiding? So God is not afraid to make a strong case and say, I understand that you face challenges in your life that will be greater than you. It's true. But I didn't make you to face them on your own. He says, remember that everything in your existence is about me, not about you. It's my story, not your story. I am bigger than anything to a degree that mathematically you can't even begin to measure out. I know everything in the past, everything in the future. Nothing gets around my attention, and I love you. Who will you turn to? Not just in your time of need, but today. Where will you go? God's laid it out, right? And there's an opportunity for you to respond. How will you respond to this God of greatness? Almighty God, I sometimes wish I didn't even need to speak up here because I know how frail I am. I know that I don't treat you with the honor that you deserve. I know that my words can't even begin to describe how incredible and amazing you are. God, I know in my own life that I have chosen my own paths. And I've lit my own fires to find my own way in this world instead of following after you. And I come with repentance before you. God, I pray that you would lead all of us to a confidence that in you we have one who is big enough and strong enough and wise enough and loving enough that we can surrender to you, God. And not use you as a buddy to help us along our own path, but just kind of submit and say, God, I just want your path. I want your life. I want the one you charted out before me. Because I'm precious to you and I'm honored to you, and because you love me and because you have given your son in exchange for me.
Great the Building. Thank you. Puedo expresar tu paz.